I've always fucking said that, like, it's better to suck on your own merits than excel borrowing someone else's knowledge. Because one of the X factor of doing it yourself is that all that knowledge stays in the business, on the team, whatever the situation.
Yeah.
When you hire contractors,
yeah,
you're paying them to build their skills.
Yeah. True. Uh-huh.
And you only become more dependent on them over time.
Yeah.
And so I've always, like, we have vendors at Hemet Law, but I've always, it's very difficult to stay a vendor.
Yeah.
You really have to push to keep up with me because if I feel like you're just coasting for even a second,
yeah,
I'll be like, thanks so much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're going to hire someone to do this internally. It's going to suck way worse, but eventually we will meet the same quality threshold and then the benefits compound from there.
Uh-huh. You know? It was really interesting. The video you recorded the other day, one thing that stuck out to me was experience is the only thing you're guaranteed.
Yep.
Like with every hire,
the
only thing you can guarantee is experience. So don't, and like, don't factor that in. Don't factor in the experience as much, because they will for sure get the experience at some point.
Yep.
But yeah, it's super interesting.
So I'm a huge believer in do it yourself and do it yourself or die.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. For the most important stuff. It's part of what made, you know, Liquid Death.
Yeah.
The water, the water company. So for those of you that don't know, Liquid Death is just a canned and bottled water company.
Uh-huh.
So you should know that the canned and bottled water company market, the water market, is saturated as fuck. You got Fiji, Dasani, Aquifer, Arrowhead. You got like a bajillion of them. And so they needed to find a way to break into that market. Yeah. Who the fuck would start a water company?
Uh-huh.
And so they counterpositioned and made it look like a beer can.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's it. That's the whole company.
Yeah.
But and they did it through outstanding marketing. And what sets Liquid Death apart is that all of their marketing is in-house, which is very unusual. Most companies, they find a creative agency and they're just like, here's $1 billion, make us X numbers of ads per year.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But then the problem is you got to move slowly. You interface between multiple teams.
Yeah.
Like everything just takes longer. You can't capitalize on social trends because by the time you get the approvals and the workflows and the meetings done, it's already passed.
Exactly.
Right. And so Liquid Death did the opposite. It's like, we're going to do it all in-house and maybe we'll suck for a while.
Yeah.
But once we figure out how to do this, we'll be able to churn out way fucking more.
Yeah. And create the most viral ads of some of the Super Bowls.
Yes.
Like you're competing against the best ad makers in the industry. In the industry. And you're standing
and
out.
And now Liquid Death went from, they captured 3% of the bottled water market within 4 years.
Yeah.
Which doesn't sound like that much until you realize that's like billions of dollars.
Yeah. Everybody drink. You guys won't believe this one simple fact.
Everyone drinks water. And I was the statistic that like 100% of people who drank water have died. Sampling bias, where are you at?
Yeah.
But which is astounding because of how hyper-saturated water is. So so actually, we should start a business podcast. Yeah. So like when in a market, follow us for more not legal content. That's what this is, a legal podcast. but I still want to talk about this.
Uh-huh.
So like what makes a business viable is hinges on what's called switching costs. How hard is it for a consumer to choose or substitute your product for one of your competitors, right? Or to make that purchasing decision. That's ultimately why it's so fucking hard to make money in restaurant, because you've got high labor costs, you've got inventory that spoils, and even if you fucking love a restaurant, I would challenge you to think of the last time you ate at your favorite restaurant more than 3 times in a week.
Yeah.
Right? Good and between, and because you can easily go somewhere else, it costs you absolutely nothing to do that, especially now that everything's on apps.
Yep.
And the same thing applies for water, is that like, it costs you fucking nothing to just reach across the aisle and pick a different water bottle.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so when you see, one of the reasons that B2B software is so valuable is that it's really organizational inertia, is that like once you onboard an organization, unless you really fuck it up, they're going to use it for a long time.
Yeah.
Right? The lifetime customer value is measured in years.
Yeah.
So like some food for thoughts.
Well, I mean, it's like the cost of switching any software is so insane. Like it's, I mean, I use a lot of creative softwares, Adobe. There's businesses all running off of the 2020 version of After Effects, because it's like, well, if we update, it'll break everything.
Yep.
Like, and so like people are actively using a software like a different version of After Effects that doesn't utilize AI as much. Yep. Like there's only one version of machine learning in it. Like all this stuff, because they're like, well, but our name tags will break. Like,
we will, how will we ever animate them? Well, yeah. I mean, and that's an interesting thought because yes, that's a practical concern, uh-huh. but it also speaks to buy-in and training.
Yeah.
Which is a huge factor when it comes to organizational change. Mm-hmm. You have to, like, your rate of change. So there's like the cost of the change, mm-hmm. the opportunity cost of the change, yeah. like, which is to say what you can't be doing while you're working on this giant project. Mm-hmm. And then third, if you don't adopt it on the other yeah. side of that change, mm-hmm. it was all for nothing.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And so like that third part is what makes it really scary uh-huh. because like you could get through the first two parts if yeah. you're really determined enough. But if you get out the other side and the team's just like,
yeah.
Nope.
Uh-huh.
Not going to use it. Yeah. You're fucked.
Yeah, exactly. And completely how fucked. Do you quantify buy-in?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, how do you do that? And I actually struggle with this. We have a small team, but uh-huh. even I struggle with, like, someone will look me in the eyes and be like, I can do that.
Yeah.
And then I come back 3 weeks later and they're like, I've never used that tool once. And I'm like,
yeah.
like, no. Uh-huh. The disintegration gif. Like,
yeah. That's so funny.
Yeah, anyways, it's something we've been thinking a lot about. Uh-huh. Anyways, for today's actual podcast uh-huh. podcast content, so how familiar are you with what Rico is as a lead in as a nice subtle pivot into this topic? How familiar are you with Rico?
I know Young Thug got charged with it.
Yep.
I know it's a racketeering, basically anti-racketeering law. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't have quite the verbiage, but I know it came into like use. Around like mob, right? Like
yep.
it was kind of to persecute mob activities.
So we've actually covered this exact issue before. Mm-hmm. RICO stands for the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. Mm-hmm. There is a federal version, but lots of states have similar, you know, state level versions.
Yeah.
And it basically means it was enacted around the 1970s mm-hmm. to target the infiltration of organized crime in a lot of strata of society. Because mm-hmm. the big fucking problem is that like, organized crime operates by having little minions do little crime
yeah.
that all in aggregate lead up to big crime.
Mm-hmm.
But like prosecutors before RICO had a really big problem was they could like bag all the little guys,
yeah.
but they couldn't connect the dots to prove it was in furtherance of a wider conspiracy
yeah.
or a wider criminal enterprise uh-huh. of some kind. And so RICO was invented to give prosecutors at the state and federal level a way to deal with basically Capone types where mm-hmm. like, where it's like, by implication,
yeah,
you were like committing organized crime. It yeah. targets organized crime.
Uh-huh.
And that's why Al Capone went away for tax evasion
yep.
and not actually running a criminal enterprise because uh-huh. they could prove they had laws on the books to yeah. prove that he was evading taxes, but they didn't have a tool to like easily get him beyond a reasonable doubt
yeah.
for running a criminal enterprise.
Mm-hmm. And they were essentially just like getting the day laborers, like yeah, not yeah, yeah. the, yeah.
Yeah. The day laborers, the temps. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it basically holds, it holds people accountable for like not just the individuals who commit specific crimes, but mm-hmm. you can actually like draw a line between the specific crime and the leadership.
Gotcha.
So that's what's anyways, where I'm going with this is that multiple Uber has sued mm-hmm. multiple personal injury firms in uh-huh. Los Angeles and a Los Angeles doctor for allegedly working together to create a scheme that repeatedly defrauds Uber as yeah, a company.
Uh-huh.
Uber is alleging that the defendant attorneys conspired with medical providers to send victims for unnecessary or unrelated medical treatment in a kickback scheme designed to generate fraudulent injury claims.
Wild.
And now Uber said that fraud like this this inflates the cost of ride sharing for mm-hmm. all users in the LA area. They claim in their lawsuit that 45% of the fares of LA area riders is goes towards the premiums of mandated coverage insurance.
Whoa.
Yeah. So Uber is more interested in ignoring a system where their drivers are left without adequate medical support after work injuries. This is Uber's third RICO filing this year against similar claims.
Wow.
Yeah. So
coming after it.
to establish the background on this case, we need to establish what like we're dealing with here. So racketeering is defined as the use of illegal activities for profit coordinated by multiple people, mm-hmm. all under the guise of making it look like legitimate business dealings. Mm-hmm. So there we go. Mm-hmm. These illegal activities can introduce fraud, extortion, bribery, threats, violence, etc. It's a catch-all that criminalizes the overall you know, business of crime, not just the individual crimes that can be proved and prosecuted in silos. Mm-hmm. Now, the statutes were built to address sort of conspiracies like this, and it does not have to be a formal under RICO. Does not have to necessarily be like a gang. Mm-hmm. It could just be any furtherance of a wider scheme.
Gotcha.
So it doesn't have to be like exactly criminally enterprise, which is interesting. It was written like that because the more specific you write a statute or a contract, this applies to contract law too, the more specific you write it, the more loopholes there are. Mm-hmm. The more loopholes there are, the harder it is to enforce. Mm. Conversely, if you write something too vaguely, then it becomes also impossible to enforce.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have to balance it. It has to be clear enough that like it's useful, but not so specific that it's easy to avoid.
Yeah.
So like if I were to say like it's a jailable offense to park on First Street on Sunday mornings, then you just park there on Sunday evenings.
Yeah, exactly.
And then now the law is useless.
Yeah.
So it would be like it's illegal to park on First Street on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's like it's the balance as opposed to it is now illegal to park on First Street sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you've got to calibrate it in that way.
Yeah, and you could probably like dodge that quote unquote like if it was just sometimes it'd be like, well, it wasn't specific enough. Like
so I should be specific and say that like RICO can be invoked via civil suit, by civil action. That's where the law's real power arises. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a prosecutorial tool. It is also a civil enforcement tool.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have corrupt organizations, you also tend to have collusion against business interests. Mm-hmm. So the government has basically said, hey, it's totally chill for you to sue people.
Mm-hmm.
If they're doing bad shit, and it basically opens up the justice system to be not semi-enforced, but like to have private parties move to further society's interest.
Yeah.
So many attorneys over the course of the 80s and 90s tried to use RICO for civil claims, but contemporarily there are several hurdles in place that must be cleared to successfully claim RICO in a civil setting.
Mm-hmm.
Most importantly, this means establishing a pattern of crime. That means showing evidence of at least two crimes. Again, at least two instances that fall under RICO's purview, and these crimes must be connected via participants, methods, victims, and they must fall under the 4-year statute of limitations. So RICO's got like a 4-year window. Statute of limitations basically means like it's a limit on when it can be brought to court.
Gotcha.
It applies civilly, and it often applies criminally, though not for murder and rape in many states. That's why you'll hear of like a guy getting convicted for murder in 1987.
Yeah, exactly.
You hear about that. But most of the time... Yeah. Public policy interests put a limit on all sorts of claims and crimes because you don't want the government being like, you shoplifted in 2007.
Yeah, exactly.
It is now 2025. And you're like, that store is gone.
Yeah.
They don't have the footage anymore. I can't defend myself. None of the witnesses even fucking remember where they were that year, let alone that day. So there's like a bunch of stuff there.
Yeah.
RICO civil suit that Uber is bringing against, the plaintiffs are bringing is the third it's filed this year. On January 30, 2025, Uber filed a racketeering suit against another group of lawyers, doctors, and pain management clinics in New York, claiming they staged fake car accidents and performed unnecessary surgeries to take advantage of New York's no-fault insurance policies.
Wow.
Under Uber claimed that since at least 2019, the defendant group conspired to, quote, exploit passengers and support for actual minor vehicle collisions, provided, quote, medically unnecessary or even invasive and painful surgeries like spinal fusions from medical conditions that are fictitious, exaggerated, or that pre-existed.
Wow.
So I should back up a little bit here. The reason this is relevant is because the way plaintiff's injury law works is that you are injured by something or someone, and then you don't actually pay anything for your attorney.
Mm-hmm.
You don't pay anything for your attorney. You go to a personal injury attorney, you say, I've been injured.
Yeah.
And then they say, we'll offer our time for free in exchange for 30 to 50% of the eventual recovery.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so it incentivizes the lawyer to fight for as much as possible because they're getting a percentage of the pot.
Mm-hmm.
What this means is you don't need to have any money to sue someone.
Mm-hmm.
And now you do have to pay for like experts and filing fees. So you only get the lawyer's time free.
Yeah.
You still have expenses.
Yeah.
But for most part, it's completely free.
Yeah. And so the lawyers are looking for types of cases that offer a high guarantee on return.
Yeah. Like, and personal injury marketing is ruthless.
Yeah.
Because like personal injury firms have no cash flow until they win.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so and you only need one whale a year.
Yeah. Right.
If you can get one case that settles for like $5 billion and you take a third of that or half of that, depending on where it was in the trial scope.
Yeah.
That's your profit for the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You don't need to, it incentivizes home runs.
Yeah.
And that can create really desperate competition. Mm-hmm. It is way more expensive to advertise in personal injury than it is to advertise in family law, which is where we practice.
Yeah.
I like family law because you only need to bat singles.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to knock it out of the fucking park.
Yeah.
But anyways, to continue this analysis, I see your question, but
oh,
let me,
no, you're good.
So to continue this analysis, what a lot of PI firms do is they've got their guy.
Mm-hmm.
They've got their doctor they consult with. They've got medical providers they like working with.
Yeah.
They've got, because there are some doctors that just consult and testify as a job.
Yeah.
They just go around, they work with law firms, they get paid by the hour, like $800 an hour to show up at trial, to write reports, to whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
They work with circles of firms.
Mm-hmm.
So what Uber is claiming here is that these firms were basically hunting down an ambulance chasing and then saying, hey, guy, go talk to our doctor. And then the doctor, knowing they get all the business from the law firms and to make the law firms as happy as possible, saying, oh, my God, you need 20 surgeries.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is relevant because in the recovery, here in Washington at least, you have special damages and general damages. So damages are just like what you lost.
Mm-hmm.
Special damages are quantifiable. They are medical expenses. They are wage you might have lost while not working, while recovering from surgery or the accident. It's stuff you, insurance premiums you had to pay. It's whatever you have receipts for.
Yeah.
General damages is stuff like pain and suffering that you can't easily quantify.
Yeah.
But we're going to focus on the special. This is important because if you can inflate the amount of treatment you have to pay for, it makes the whole pot bigger.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And remember, the lawyer isn't responsible to pay for medical costs. That comes out of the client's slice of the pie.
Uh-huh.
So in theory, if you can get the pie as expensive as possible and then settle the whole thing on Uber's insurance and then let the client deal with the fallout, who cares what the client gets, and then you do this often enough, it can cause a real fucking problem for everybody.
Yeah, so your half of the pie looks sweet.
Yes, exactly. And and especially in expensive metropolitan areas, and if your client doesn't have health insurance. Remember, insurance, medical costs are made up. You can get, like, I had a friend who went to the ER without insurance once, and she got $800 bill for the ER, like, handing her some Benadryl.
Yeah.
Right? And she didn't have insurance, so she fucking fought with debt collectors for 2 years before she settled for, luckily, pennies on the dollar.
Nice.
But most people, if they don't have insurance and they go in and they just like, sorry, need a spinal fusion. That'll be $900,000 for surgery and recovery.
Yeah.
And now you get to go to Uber and say, sorry, we had the spinal. The doctor said it was necessary.
Yeah.
That's the scheme.
Uh-huh. And now the lawyer's walking out with $500,000.
Yeah, walking out with way more in theory.
Yeah.
Now, I should say, this is very unethical. Mm-hmm. I want to be very clear. This is not best business practices. I actually should have emphasized that earlier. I'm not saying do this. If your attorney is doing this, be very careful. Ask them how often they work with the specific doctor you're going to go see, or go see your original doctor before you talk to an attorney. Always seek full medical attention immediately. And that's actually part of the balancing act here, is that when you're injured in a personal injury incident, you actually are expected and mandated to get the treatment you need. If you don't, go to the doctor immediately. And if you don't get whatever the doctor recommends to get you in a fixed and stable position as soon as possible, that's actually reason for the insurance, for the company to be like, yeah, we broke your leg maybe.
Yeah.
But like, you then walked on it for 6 months without getting a cast, and now your leg's fucked. We're not paying for that.
Yeah.
Because really what happened here is that you didn't seek medical attention. So it's not surprising that this scheme, if proven to exist, has gone on for so long because it's a careful balancing act.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was one of the things that Mike Rafe said when we talked to him was like, go see a doctor immediately.
Yeah.
Like, that's the answer always.
We used to do a little bit of personal injury a long time ago at this office. It was like a side practice of ours, and people would call. And I'd be like, oh my God, like I was hit by a car. And I'm like, oh my God, that's terrible. How you doing? And they're like, oh, I'm okay. And I'm like, call over.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sorry. I can only help you if you've been seriously injured. I mean, you're bruised. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, exactly.
But like, sorry.
There's not really.
And then in the alternative, we'd be like, oh my God, go to a doctor. And the doctor would be like, hey, you need a surgery.
Yeah.
And then they didn't want the surgery. Mm. And we're like, we're done here.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, well, it destroys your claim if you don't get the medical treatment recommended. Mm-hmm. So anyways.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyways, many states have regulations that help drivers and passengers get reimbursed for medical costs or lost wages after an accident. But to talk about the New York case I was just mentioning, the other parallel RICO lawsuit, the taxi industry regulators require cab and rideshare drivers to carry personal injury coverages high as $200,000.
Wow.
This is significantly more than the $50,000 requirement for individual drivers, and of course makes cab and rideshare drivers more attractive targets for fraud because they know there's mandated insurance coverage, and policy limits usually sets the tenor of the recovery. Uber believes they're being exploited by racketeering rings such as conspiring law firms under Uber CEO Dario, oh boy, the podcast where we do not know how to pronounce things, look at that. Khosrowshahi.
Wow, that's a hard one.
Yeah, I don't know. Uber CEO. Sorry, we'll put that. Maybe we'll put that up on screen. Maybe we'll put that in the description so you guys know I'm not just. Anyways, he's pushing for Uber, and their executive leadership is pushing for insurance and tort reform to address these insurance costs, which he says is causing prices to increase and therefore resulting in slowdown in ride bookings. Mm-hmm. So you may say, who cares if Uber's paying all this? One, they're a multi-billion-dollar company. But two, more importantly, they've got insurance.
Yeah.
Who cares if they're paying all this money out to individual people? Isn't that awesome? Well, the problem is then the insurance company at the end of every year turns around and says, hey, you had like 8,000 claims. We're doubling your premiums.
Yeah.
And then Uber, better or for worse, is saying, we're not carrying this cost.
Yeah.
Raise the price. You know, raise the rideshare price to 20% to cover the insurance.
Yeah, which 45%, if that quote is true, what they said earlier is the 45% of each fare going towards
the mandated insurance.
Yeah,
premiums.
Mandated insurance is crazy.
Well, I mean, there's also like that's what I will say. There's also a propensity for these rideshare and app delivery to ham it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like when if you order Uber, not Uber Eats. If you order,
DoorDash.
So Seattle passed a mandate requiring that all delivery and Uber and et cetera drivers be paid, like, I think it's something like $27 an hour plus a couple of benefits. They passed that law, and in response, Uber and DoorDash and all the other Eats apps put in a Seattle regulatory response fee just to, like, cry about it every single time. Anyways, yeah. So, like, there is a high incentive for these companies to, like, ham it up a little bit. Okay, anyways, I also want to talk about the second Uber a RICO suit, because remember, there's been three of them. Mm-hmm. This one against a Miami law firm and medical center on June 11th. So like in June of this year, alleging a similar racketeering setup. Uber accused the personal injury firm Law Group of South Florida, very, very creative name, and the firm's managing attorney, Andy Lyonnaz, of scheming to pay drivers to intentionally collide with other cars and then claim they were using the Uber app while driving.
Wow.
Yeah. They said that local auto mechanics and healthcare providers at River Medical Center and other clinics in Miami falsely claimed the crashes caused severe injuries and required medical treatments, and those false statements formed the basis of bogus lawsuits against Uber and its insurer, according to the Florida lawsuit. Mm. They alleged that five stage crashes happened between 2023 and 2024. Near, I think it's Halea, Florida. After each crash, attorneys Lyonnaz would submit insurance claims to the people and provided for the maximum amount allowed under the policy, $1 million.
Yeah.
Uber is claiming. After four crashes, Lyonnaz filed lawsuits that named Uber and its commercial auto liability insurance carrier. The suit is also still pending in Florida court.
Wow.
Yeah.
I love the just maxing it out every time.
Oh, well, like, that's pretty common.
Okay.
Because, like, personal injury attorneys are like this isn't worth our time to spend 5 years trying to enforce. We're just going to go like, cause I hit a guy once like in my car and it wasn't that big a deal. No one was hurt, but I like destroyed his fender and he was pissed about it. But I was like, look, man, I've got insurance. Mm-hmm. Here's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Here's my insurance information. Mm-hmm. You sue me.
Yeah.
Right. And then I will just hand the complaint off to my insurance carrier and they'll hire someone to defend me. Mm-mm. And that's it.
Yep.
That's what insurance is.
Yeah.
Now he could, maybe it would be worth his time to like demand policy limits, mm-hmm. and then up to the policy limits after that, my carrier would be like, okay, now we've hit policy limits, now you're on the hook for anything left. But like, it's just not fucking worth everyone's time to like, if you can get $1 million, mm-hmm. it's not much more than $1.1 million, which is way more than most people have.
Yeah.
And it would take an additional 4 years.
Yeah.
So like, policy limits is pretty normal.
Yeah. Gotcha.
In fact, one of the big disputes in PI cases, the big point of discovery in PI cases, mm-hmm. is like, what's the insurance limit?
Mm-hmm.
Give us your insurance coverage documents. Mm-hmm. So we know what to claim, how to claim. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the strategies in PI is like knowing what causes of action to bring, uh-huh. because only specific causes of action are covered under specific insurance claims. So
gotcha.
Like, for example, Hemet Law has employment insurance, mm-hmm. right? We have employment insurance. And so if I were to fire someone and they mm-hmm. were to sue us for wrongful termination or whatever, then that would cover, trigger the duty to defend, right? That would trigger our insurance policy mm-hmm. to come in and save us.
Yeah.
But if we fired someone, they sued us for wrongful termination, and I'm trying to think, I don't know, unjust enrichment or uh-huh. something like that.
Yeah.
That's not employment related.
Mm-hmm.
So that would go under our general liability uh-huh. insurance. But maybe our general liability insurance has insurance riders for like specific events. So basically you have to be tactical because you want the insurance.
Yeah, exactly.
You want the insurance as much mm-hmm. as possible. Yeah, because you want to go after someone with deep pockets.
Yeah.
Okay, but anyways, this brings us to the actual complaint we're looking at today.
Mm-hmm.
In their third RICO civil suit this year, Uber is bringing their allegations of racketeering and collusion between the LA, so the LA defendants. So there's like Florida, New York, LA, which are mm-hmm. like three big metropolitan areas with highly competitive PI practices. Does not surprise me. Anyways, specifically, Uber is suing downtown LA law with attorney Igor Fradkin.
Yeah, what a name.
I will say that's like Fade Rautha levels of Dune.
Uh-huh. Like, true.
The fucking Nah Baron Igor Fradkin.
Uh-huh.
I love Dune Part Dude 2, by the
spice.
Way.
Spice.
Yeah, exactly. The injuries must flow.
Uh-huh.
the fucking law offices of Jacob Amrani, which mm-hmm. of course is, Amrani? Amrani? Mm. I do not look up how to pronounce these guys' names beforehand, as has been very clear. And chiropractic clinic GSK Spine and chiropractor Greg Kunganian.
Yeah, I feel like that's honest attempt.
Yeah, good faith attempt there. Uh-huh. And Radiant Surgery Center. So basically, gotcha. Downtown LA Law and the law offices of Jacob Amrani, and then GSK Spine, a chiropractic clinic, and then Radiant Surgery Center.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a fairly big. That's a fairly big conspiracy circle, but mm-hmm. it's not so big that I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Right? Because the law offices, Jacob is a very small practitioner, and downtown LA law is also a very small team.
Mm.
And it's talking with GSK Spine. I looked them up. They're fairly small.
Yeah.
Right? So these might be people stupid enough.
Well, and I don't know how you feel about chiropractors, but I'm just going to throw up a red flag there.
I will say chiropractors are like where you go in and try and get your head ripped off by a guy that couldn't graduate from law school or from medical school. Yeah,
exactly. Well, it's just like, I don't know. I used to work with dentists, and dentists are kind of like it's a similar level of like, yeah, they're a doctor, but they're not like...
Do not let the dentist hear you say that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I'm just saying, I think dentists would back me up on this, is that there are some crazy dentists out there.
100%.
Like, you run into... Because, like, if you're going to 10 years of medical school, you have to have a good head on your shoulder.
Yeah.
Like, but if you're going to, like, three or 4 years...
It's so interesting, because, like, dentists, CPAs, and lawyers, mm-hmm. their limiting factor is their marketing and business acumen,
mm-hmm.
right? And which is not something any of them are trained on.
Yeah.
And they're all self-regulated. Mm-hmm. So I was talking to my orthodontist like a year ago, mm-hmm. and he was like, yeah, I know some fucking crazy people.
Yeah.
But because we're self-regulated, you mm-hmm. have to pretty much kill someone in broad daylight to get your medical license taken away.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, that's scary.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fucking scary. Uh-huh. I don't want to know that. Who are you? You know, like.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. No. Yeah. That's, you just run into some dentists with like, especially during the COVID days, sending you some crazy emails.
Yeah, exactly. Anyways, we'll go into the specifics of the scheme here. Uber believes that, as we said at the very start of the podcast, that the LA scheme has created fraudulent bills and records of medical necessity slash causation to artificially inflate the damages of lawsuits. So causation is also important because you need a medical provider to say that, like, this injury was caused by X event, right? So if, let's say you had a bad back and then you got in, like, a fender bender and then your spine broke.
Yeah.
And then, like, yeah, that's terrible, but, like, the problem here wasn't our conduct.
Yeah.
The problem here is that you already had a bad spot. And so you'd spend your time arguing about, like, to what degree was this event the real causing factor.
Yeah.
So maybe there'd be some, like, liability there, but it wouldn't be total.
Yeah.
And so you need a medical provider to say that, like, yep, this is definitely why.
Yeah, exactly.
So, so Uber states that the surgery center and the spine center generated profit via artificially inflated rates for performing unnecessary, unrelated surgeries and procedures, and then claiming part of the plaintiff's recovery. Attorneys Amirani and Fradkin and their law firms profit through the larger settlements by introducing the fraudulent medical records and artificially inflated billing procedures. While Uber says they are the main target of the scheme, they do not believe they're the only ones who are being targeted. So Uber is trying to make an example of them.
Gotcha.
Now, Uber is alleging they are the main target of the scheme because of their large, lucrative company. First off, Uber fucking self-flexing from Perkins Coie. That's that's pretty funny. But I will also say that, like, yeah, deep pockets are pretty important. They believe that the attorney defendants identify individuals with potential personal injury claims against rideshare companies like Uber because California law requires rideshare companies to carry $1 million of liability and motorist insurance coverage per incident. Uber believes that defendants see the claim as highly profitable cases regardless of the severity of the actual injuries because they just fucking go after their insurance.
Yeah.
Both defendant firms aggressively pursue clients to sue Uber, with Amirani even billing himself as the rideshare accident expert in his TV advertisements. See page 9. Uber is alleging that the fixation is actually harmful to accident victims because the law firms are taking advantage of claimants that are most vulnerable and facing economical and medical stress. Uber says the defendant firms routinely charge contingency fees of 45% or higher. Yeah.
That's wild.
Yep. Now it's, I will say I have seen contingency fees up to 55%, but like the way our contingency fees work is that you, when we were doing personal injury back in the day, is like 35%, you agree to a blanket 35% if we take your case. And then if it goes to, if it gets to a point where we're going to trial, then it bumps to 50%. And then, and then if we go to appeal, it bumps to 60%. And so it would be like gated.
Yeah.
So it depends on the bars, but like, 40% or higher is pretty high if it's an initial starting.
Yeah.
Right. So you want to aim for like 30, 35 to start. That's already a third of your recovery. And then up to 55 if it's like you're doing intensive work to prep for trial.
Gotcha.
Now, these, remember, rideshare drivers and riders in the areas of LA County that they're targeting were low income. The Spanish speaking, like, on average, low income. They work hard manual labor jobs. And so Uber is arguing that, like, hey, going after these guys is predatory. While most of the victims who seek Fradkin and Amirani's service have their own pre-existing insurance, Uber says that the attorneys push claimants away from qualifying providers to the medical defendants who they work with. So, like, they push them away from their normal general practitioner. Uber believes that these providers, GSK Spine and Radiant Surgery, require the claimants to sign their own lien agreements where they agree to pay back the providers via recoveries on their claims. Upon seeing these, which is unusual, which is very unusual, upon seeing these lien agreements, Uber says the contracts these claimants signed actually made the patients wholly responsible for the medical fees, and the fees were not contingent on settlement or any other form of recovery.
Oh my goodness.
So they're arguing that, like, hey, that's like, this is very unusual that you're just having them take it all on without, without contingency.
Yeah.
They also believe that bills and medical defendants generated were way larger than needed in most cases. Uber is also claiming the attorneys and medical providers have coordinated with these lawsuits they file. They do not, in fact, lead to excess recovery. Medical providers will ultimately reduce the size of the bill, which the attorneys then falsely claim credit for and maintains the image for future clients. So basically, they pump up the bill, make the client wholly responsible. Take the money, and then since it's all part of a racketeering ring, if the if there's not enough recovery for the medical provider, then they, like, do this whole song and dance where they, like, hey, I'll, don't worry, I'll call the center, we'll take it all. And then they drop the bill on paper way down, and then they look to get to look like heroes to their clients while basically robbing them blind.
Isn't that
I don't want to say genius, but that's actually very creative.
I mean, there's stuff like this, it's always like, oh, that's pretty good idea. Like, you can see the kernel of like, I can see why he was stoked on whatever he came up with that.
Yeah, I'm not unethical. Follow us for more unethical practice tips. So I want to walk you through the story of what Uber is calling claimant A.
Mm-hmm.
So four examples of four real life claimants who are part of the alleged racketeering scheme. I want to go through an example. So in December 9th of 2019, an individual named claimant A was involved in a minor crash with another vehicle where no one was injured, as determined by police. They actually provide the police report. Look on page 13 of the complaint. Claimant A did not go to the ER after the crash, bad, but sought medical treatment a week after the accident for muscle pain, a visit that was covered by their insurance. Mm-hmm. So not ideal.
Yeah.
A full week has passed.
Mm-hmm.
Better to go to the hospital right away.
Yeah.
According to Uber, claimant A retained the Emirati firm and they directed claimant A to Dr. Dr. K, who recommended and performed a cervical fusion in late 2020 and back surgery in early 2021 on the patient, costing more than $550,000 in total. Uber further asserts that the Emirati firm had pushed Dr. K to schedule the surgeries for claimant ASAP because the case involved Uber and the $1 million insurance cap.
Mm.
None of these procedures were covered by claimant's A standing insurance.
Wow.
Uber says that this independent medical expert indicates the care was necessary below the standard of care and was billed up to 10 times the market rate.
Wow.
Yeah, and so they pushed them into these huge... Remember, no one was injured, visibly injured. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have injuries that aren't visible.
Yep.
So, like, put a pin in that.
Mm-hmm.
But police were like, no one was visibly injured. There was no bruising. Yep. There was no blood on the scene. Mm-hmm. You still should go to the hospital, get it checked out, because neck pain and concussions are real.
Yeah.
But it was not, like, a horrible pileup, is what Uber's trying to say.
Exactly.
And then all of a sudden, you're getting, like, a cervical fusion and back surgery.
Yeah.
And it's not covered by your insurance, so these firms are just saddling them with that.
Yeah.
Now, and it was billed at 10 times the market rate for these procedures.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah. Claimant B, another story, quote, repeatedly reported no pain after an accident that involved a vehicle crash with an Uber Eats driver, because remember, Uber Eats is also covered by their insurance. Mm-hmm. On March 10th of 2019, the claimant retained Emirati for representation, and on December 28th, 2020, the attorney mailed a demand letter to Uber stating the claimant was suffering from spinal injuries and would need future surgery. In March of 2021, claimant B filed a lawsuit against Uber. In May of 2021, more than 2 years after the accident, Dr. K recommended claimant B be scheduled for a $226,000 lumbar procedure after a telehealth appointment.
Oh, wow.
They fucking did that shit on Zoom.
Like, I could tell your lumbar is out of whack.
And no in-person assessment was conducted until the day of the surgery.
Oh, my God. None. That is crazy.
Yeah, as follow-up to his first surgery, claimant B had more than 10 sessions of physical therapy, once again repeatedly reporting having zero pain to her physical therapist. Despite this, Dr. K later signed a follow-up record where he stated claimant B would need two additional spinal surgeries in the near future, totaling $265K. Though this has not yet come to pass. In total, claimant B's medical bills in relation to this case now allegedly cost more than $330,000.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Now, claimant C.
Quarter milli.
And climbing. Up to half milli. Mm-hmm. On March 8th, 2019, claimant C was traveling in an Uber when his driver's vehicle had a minor collision at an intersection in L.A. Claimant C was already en route to LAX for a flight to their home city of St. Louis. Within minutes of the accident, the claimant hailed another ride to catch their flight. Mm. Once back in St. Louis, they saw a chiropractor upon arriving. Nice. Who treated the claimant for over 16 sessions and said that claimant C did not report any higher levels of pain in his lower back, with the claimant even going as far as posting videos online, dancing and singing in a music video. Page 22 of the complaint.
Yeah.
Despite this chiropractic treatment in St. Louis, claimant C also retained downtown LA Law Group. Within weeks of the accident in September of 2019, the firm directed claimant C to see Dr. K in LA, whereupon the claimant described feelings of lumbar pain suddenly. Uber then claims that Dr. K knew or was recklessly indifferent to the fact that claimant C's stated injuries were false or minor. Since he had not stated he had experienced such levels of pain in the immediate aftermath of the accident or through his treatment in St. Louis, the doctor recommended, you guessed it, several spinal surgeries for the claimant, which were discussed again when they met for the second time in September of 2022. Claimant C would finally undergo a micro discectomy and decompression surgery in January 2023, spine surgery. Mm-hmm. The total cost for care of claimant C exceeded $246,000, with Dr. K's total bill for the surgery being $108,433.15.
Wow.
Per page 25.
Yeah.
Per the filing, an independent expert determined that the reasonable value of services performed was only about $10,000.
Yeah. Well, okay. So here's my background that you brought up the hypothetical of me having a bad back. Yeah. I had scoliosis.
Yeah.
And I got like my entire spine taken apart. Like they took out all these growth plates, put in a bunch of rods. So like half of my spine is like titanium. It was $100,000.
Oh,
like,
shit.
Like, you know what I mean? But that's rebuilding my spine.
Yeah, that's a spinal rebuild.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And these guys are like, first off, I don't want to say that's rad, but that's kind of metal.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of sick. It's kind of sick. Uh-huh. No, yeah. A long time ago. Yeah. So I was on my dad's insurance. Thank God.
Oh, thank God. Well, I mean, and that's so much interesting here is that, like, just repeated the volume.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can just keep going to a chiropractor, keep going to a surgery, keep going to a specialist. You can really pump those numbers up in the American system.
Mm-hmm.
And for one last victim, claimant D, who was a passenger in a 3-car rear-end collision that involved an Uber. The police reported no injuries, and the claimant did not seek medical treatment but did retain Downtown LA Law Group. Between January and May 2019, the claimant did pursue shockwave therapy, but by the end of the year, claimant D was seeking out pain management clinics.
Mm.
Downtown LA Law Group then steered the claimant towards Dr. K for further treatment.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor referred claimant D to an acupuncturist and physical therapist, and by the end of the claimant's months-long treatment plan, this one's fun, reported no pain. However, in March of 2021... The boys and girls at Downtown LA Law Group helped claimant D write a letter of demand asking for $750,000 from Uber to resolve claims. This matter, they actually settled. Uber is just salty. They incurred the cost of litigation.
Okay.
Yeah. We're seeing a pretty clear pattern here.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to remark on that. I think it's not unusual for demand letters to go out to have ludicrous made up numbers.
Well, and far be it from me to take the side of Uber. I'm getting their side of the story, so I feel like I'm taking more their side of the story, but far be it from me.
Similarly, there is some nuance here. A lot of soft tissue and musculature injuries are not always apparent, and the police are not medical providers. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to say that, like, this is definitely racketeering.
Yeah.
But I do want to. I do believe that PI injuries push the fold pretty heavily.
Yeah.
I just don't know if specifically these stories are like a slam dunk for Uber.
Uh-huh.
Claimant D is probably the weakest.
Yeah.
Because like you can sending a demand letter for a big scary number.
Yeah.
Everyone fucking does that. It doesn't matter. It's just a demand letter.
Yeah, exactly.
You settle for something completely different later.
Uh-huh.
It's like when in lawsuits when like you hear some guy's like, oh, guy sues other guy for $10 bajillion dollars. And that's made up.
Yeah.
What you put, the number you put on the bottom of your complaint literally doesn't matter. It always changes later. Mm-hmm. There's discovery, there's negotiations, there's whatever. And so what attorneys do is they think they just pull a number, giant number out of their ass to get media attention.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So a similar phenomenon happens with like shock and awe because your first demand letter sets the threshold of window of negotiation.
Yeah.
So you set it high.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then you settle somewhere below it.
Which is just basically bargaining.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You might as well go high and then get talked down.
Yeah. And I think we're going to go over causes of action here.
Mm-hmm.
It is a RICO case. So RICO violation in reference to GSK Spine, which Uber's claiming committing wire and mail fraud by knowingly participating in a scheme meant to defraud Uber. Second cause of action of RICO violation in reference to Downtown LA Law Group, which Uber claims is committing wire and mail fraud, again, participating in the scheme. And then RICO violations in reference to the law offices of Jacob M. Ronnie, which Uber is claiming, again, mail fraud, knowingly participating in a scheme. And RICO reference to the association, in fact, enterprise.
Mm.
Basically, all the gang working together.
Yeah.
So basically against the whole thing for saying wire fraud and mail fraud allegations, and then conspiracy, RICO conspiracy, alleging that all the defendants knowingly and intentionally work together in this way to like defraud Uber, which is a separate cause of action, and then unjust enrichment, benefits the defendants received via their fraudulent scheme for medical records and lien agreements at Uber's expense, and then violation of business and professional code, basically just like consumer practice protections.
Yeah.
Uber is seeking judgment for restitution, damages and interest, legal fees and equitable and other relief. They're also demanding a trial by jury. Here's what I think. I think my takeaways for this issue are that there are scumbag PI attorneys. I don't know if it's these guys specifically, but there are definitely scumbag PI attorneys, because remember, you can be poor. You don't need money to hire PI lawyers.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they don't have to be discerning about who their clients are. And so there are desperate PI lawyers who just go to vulnerable populations, to immigrant populations, to non-English speaking op. They just get them to sign their agreement, and then they just go buck wild, right? They point them who to get treated by. They tell them when to settle, even though they're not supposed to.
Yeah.
Right? They're very much steering, when the client should always be steering strategy and litigation whenever possible. And so it's really easy for that to fly under the radar.
Gotcha.
Particularly when you're suing like non-sympathetic targets. Like when a business gets big enough, it will get sued.
Yeah.
Hemet Law has been sued. Mm-hmm. I've been sued. Mm-hmm. My software company will eventually get sued. It's still a pretty new company, but like eventually you get a big enough target, you're eventually going to get, someone's going to say something, right? And so far be it from me to side with Uber. I do think these guys have all the hallmarks of somewhat questionable PI practices. Mm-hmm. But I also know that Uber has a very strong vested interest to push the propaganda that like personal injuries attorneys are scumbags and they shouldn't exist and no one should take money from us. Mm-hmm. So are you familiar with the McDonald's case?
I was just thinking of that. Yeah.
So for those of you that don't know, there was an old, I think she was like 85 at the time, in like 2007 or something. It was in the 2000s. It doesn't matter specifically when, but she went through the McDonald's drive-thru and she spilled hot coffee on herself. And then she sued McDonald's for like $5 million and won.
Yeah.
Right. Companies have used that ever since as a huge propaganda tool to be like, oh, it's coffee, these PI lawyers, all this liability is out of control. We got to write laws so that that can't happen. People are abusing the system.
Yeah.
What really happened was that that specific McDonald's had been serving coffee at almost twice the safe temperature and had been warned. Multiple people had been injured up to that point.
Yeah.
And they had done nothing to change it.
Mm-hmm.
Then when she spilled the coffee on herself, the coffee was practically boiling. Like it wasn't just hot coffee, it was basically boiling water. Her not to get graphic, but she like fucking basically fused her genitals. It like, because they like her skin melted.
Yeah.
And she didn't, she spent the rest of her life in pain and unable to walk again.
Jesus.
Right. And the penalty that McDonald's paid was equivalent of, I think, like one day just of coffee sales. That's what they paid. It meant almost nothing to them.
Yeah.
Right. But that case has been enormously valuable to McDonald's and other companies like it over since then.
Yeah.
Because they've been able to pump it as a propaganda piece to be like, oh, spilling coffee or you're, how fucking
everybody's suing everyone nowadays.
Yeah. Everyone's, oh, we've got to stop this. When in reality, PI attorneys do serve a critical function to hold people accountable for like malfeasance. They're accessible. They're the one area of law that remains accessible to everyone because you don't need any money to claim them. I mean, there's plenty of problems inherent in that system, but like they serve a critical role.
Yeah.
Right. And in general, I don't think recoveries are ever abused because, like, if you hear of a big recovery from a personal injury claim, it means you're horribly injured.
Yeah.
Now, I have never met a PI client who wouldn't trade their $5 million in to get their legs back.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's never worth it to them. Even $10 million to never walk again. Mm-hmm. Would you take that trade?
Yeah, no.
No. Uh-uh. Yeah, fuck yeah. No. I want to run. Uh-huh. I want to walk. I want to move independently. I don't want to have to have someone wipe my ass.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's to speak nothing of chronic pain or treatments you'll need for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. It's, the system exists, and it's good, and it's capable of doing good, but it is not easily abused to the level that these companies want you to think it is.
Yeah.
Right. And so I also am very skeptical of Uber's claim that like half of the fees are going towards to blame the all the people we're crashing into keep demanding money from us. How dare they? Like that, when you think about that phrasing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if I buy it. Like Uber is clearly trying to discredit the personal injury field as a whole. And our producer Megan rightly points that out in our notes here. There are reasons to be skeptical of any lawyer. Uber is clearly trying to build support for reducing insurance requirements and liabilities, so their ass isn't on the line as often.
Yeah.
Right. Cause remember, this is a public media campaign. They are strategically filing these lawsuits to make examples of these attorneys in their biggest, most libelous markets.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so they want people to, they're sending a chilling message to clients, but more importantly, they're sending chilling messages to the practitioners that take these cases. And then their real audience is the state legislatures.
Yeah.
They want the state legislatures to buy into this. And then next, next fucking legislative session write in a law that reduces the liability,
yeah,
or obviates them entirely. In fact, the Georgia legislature this last year, they wrote a law that says, you know, Monsanto, the weed killer that gives you fucking mesothelioma. Georgia just straight up said, you can't sue them. The Georgia legislature said specifically, you cannot sue Monsanto for injuries that result from their chemical byproducts.
Insane.
Yeah, and that's an extreme example, but you see similar examples of like the gun industry. You can't sue a gun, generally speaking, you can't sue a gun manufacturer for what someone does with their weapons.
Yeah.
And now, I do agree with the intent there, but there's a second problem that arises from that. So I've talked about this before. When you sue someone, there's something called discovery. Right. Yeah. Discovery allows you to ask them questions, demand produce documents. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can interview people at the top of the company. You get all sorts of access to information that is not publicly available.
Yeah.
When you restrict someone from even being sued in the first place, you basically stop the public inquiry.
Yeah.
Right. And so you lose that access. It's a transparency tool. Mm-hmm. And so when someone's like, we can't be sued for this.
Yeah.
A company will just like fucking put whatever they want in writing, do whatever the fuck they want, knowing that they don't even have to respond to discovery.
Yeah.
And so I always tell people, be very careful. Mm-hmm. Be very careful about making a company completely immune from certain behaviors, because not only is that bad right on its face, but there are downstream effects about what the public gets to see the powerful are doing when they think no one is watching.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Exactly.
And I think that's something the legal industry actually does very well.
Mm-hmm. Is provide the channels for that discovery.
That window. Yeah. Because it's kind of crazy. Like in our society, you can sue someone and then just demand stuff from them.
Yeah.
Like you don't even have to prove your case yet. That if I spent like 2 hours putting something together, I could sue Apple and like demand everything they know about me. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Or crazy shit like that. Yeah. It's actually kind of mind boggling that we live in a society that transparent.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think I have mixed feelings on this. I think it's a sensationalist story. And I also think it's interesting that they went after small practitioners, relatively small practitioners, and not the big law firms.
Yeah.
Morgan & Morgan, like a huge personal injury firm that's countrywide, they didn't go after them.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they're doing settlement mills just like this. They went after law firms that are too small, that are large enough to be recognized in the community, but too small to put up a real fight in the face of the enormity of Uber and their huge legal department at Perkins Coie. Perkins Coie, headquartered here in Seattle, boys and go Seahawks, you know. but I mean, these giant firms, I think that's very intentional, the targets they picked.
Yeah.
Right? I think in Florida and New York, they picked regional firms that are like dozens of attorneys, but still small players.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't pick someone that's on their level. Because even as an attorney, getting sued by Uber, you're the underdog.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Because even if you represent yourself, which you won't, right? But even if you, which is a stupid idea, I emphasize this, but even if you represent yourself, that's time away from your cases, that's time away from managing your practice, it slows everything down, it stresses you out, it's just a drain on your mental resources before you get to the financial cost. Second thing is being on the defending side of a lawsuit, you have to pay your attorney hourly.
Yeah.
So you're faced with an opponent who loses nothing to fight forever.
Yeah.
And then you, your guy charges you $600 an hour.
Uh-huh.
And so even if you've done absolutely nothing wrong, you want to settle as quickly as possible, because even if you fight this thing out to a defense verdict, you're going to be out like $100,000 in attorney's fees.
Yeah, which is why slap suits are so effective.
Yeah, like, slap suits are highly effective. Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. So what are your final thoughts on this one, Sam?
Well, I mean, I think it's really that, I don't want anyone thinking that I was taking, I'm taking Uber's side after that, because at the end of the day, it is the classic like gig economy of like, no, we're just an app. Like we don't need insurance. Like these are just all independent actors.
Yep.
And sometimes they get in wrecks, but we're not responsible for if they get in wrecks. Like it's the individual. They're contractors. Those are business owners.
Yeah. Yeah. They protect small business.
Yeah. Exactly.
Guys, protect small businesses. What are we even doing?
Don't sue Uber.
Us here
protect
Uber,
small business.
Yeah. Yeah. Us here at Uber Incorporated are all about small businesses. Anyways, we're just we just provide them with a little app.
Yeah.
What do we know? I mean, you've put your, because contractors are a great way to limit. And the WWE is famous for this. So the WWE, what they do is they claim all of their wrestlers are independent contractors. So they don't, generally speaking, they don't give them health insurance. They don't let them wrestle with any other association. Mm-hmm. They control everything about their contract. They can cancel it at any time. In every way, they work a fucking wrestler to death. Mm-hmm. They have them. There's no off season in wrestling. It goes fucking year round. They're doing like one show per day year round.
Yeah.
And these are physically demanding events before you get to the part where you get hit on the head with a metal chair.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
And that made sense. The WWE back in the day was actually one of about like 30 associated regional wrestling conglomerations. Mm-hmm. And so back then, being an independent contractor made sense because you could wrestle with different associations, do different media appearances. They were independent contractors that controlled their character and their narrative. Mm-hmm. Right. But now WWE is almost a monopoly.
Yeah.
And they have retained the contractor schema so that they face way less liability when they die 20 years early from brain damage or health complications, which on average, they do. Uh-huh. They wrestlers die, I think, 15 years even earlier than NFL players.
It's crazy.
Which also die, I think, 7 years earlier than the general population on average because they spend all their time hitting their heads on stuff. And sure, you can survive that in your 20s and 30s, but the health effects of a traumatic brain injury, a TBI, isn't going to show up right away. It's going to show up when you're 50, 60, 70, 80, when your neuroplasticity begins to degrade and your brain can no longer compensate for the damage.
Yeah.
And so you see epilepsy, you see neurodegenerative disorders, you see I want to say, what is it? Not amnesia. What's dementia?
Dementia.
Alzheimer's diseases, neurodegenerative cognitive deficiencies. Yeah, you see all sorts of diseases manifest later in life. And they do that to limit the liability downside of caring for these contractors.
Yeah.
So there's actually been a big push. I mean, that the WWE is like a whole fucking other thing, but there's been a big push to take better care of these wrestlers in retirement. Anyways, we'll wrap it up here by saying I have mixed feelings. Mm-hmm. I think there's definitely something here, but I also really want to stress that Uber has very, very, very strong financial interests. So anyways, we're going to cut it here, guys. Thank you so much for joining us. GossipAboutPrejudice.com. Give us money.
Yeah.
Follow, share, like. We really like putting these out. If you guys are still enjoying the content, we so appreciate our subscribers who, for some reason, give us a little bit of money every single month to do this. So we greatly appreciate all of you guys listening in. We'll put more stuff out on social media. GossipAboutPrejudice@gmail.com. If you want to reach us, thanks so much.
Later.